Campus Beard li ta' Punzaba jipprezenta Colin Fitz jistaqsi kull nhar ta' sibt u kull nhar ta' ħadd. Jiena Colin nistaqsi mistoqsijiet pertinenti lin-nies li jew jagħmlu xogħol interessanti, jew għaddew minn xi avventura, jew ippubblikaw xi ktieb li nħoss li għandu jinqara minn ħafna nies. Forsi żaru postijiet imbeda u ta' min nitkellmu dwar dawn il-vjaġġi. Suġġetti varji li jiena ċert li jinteressawkom is-semija ta' Campus 103.7 Colin Fitz jistaqsi nhar ta' sibt fl-erba u nhar ta' ħadd fit-tlieta ta' wara nofsinhar. Welcome to the show, Professor Eleanor Sherry. We've seen a lot about you. We've seen many interviews with you as well over the course of 2025, particularly about your most recent, you and your colleagues' most recent discoveries about early life on the Maltese Islands and possibly all around the Mediterranean, going back 1,000 years earlier than what was thought before. So amazing discoveries in the world of archaeology. Once again, welcome, Professor Sherry.
Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to have you here. It's been seeing you all over the media, including the international media, well, National Geographic, and being interviewed. This is a really big find that you had here in Malta. Is it the Latnija cave?
It is, yes.
Why did it make so many waves around the world?
It's funny you mention waves, because that probably cuts to the crux of the matter. I think for Malta, obviously, the big story that captures people's imagination was that it pushed back Maltese prehistory by at least a millennium. And not just any millennium, but it pushed Maltese prehistory back into a deeper time frame of human prehistory, which is a time before the development of agriculture. Yeah. And, you know, the prehistory of hunter-gatherers, which is what humans were for the bulk of human prehistory. But I think what really, as you say, made waves internationally was the fact that it was a big story about seafaring. So hunter-gatherers are not supposed to have been able to make it to small and remote islands like Malta, either because they didn't have the seafaring technology to be able to do this, or because it wasn't there, it wasn't in there, you know, it wasn't worth them making that kind of journey. And this is because hunter-gatherers live on what Earth provides.
Yeah.
So they need to exploit really large land areas to get enough food. So it's not like farmers who have crops, which are obviously modified plants that have been bred to have a much more productive yield. They're relying on wild plants and wild foods. And of course, if you consume too many of these things and you have to wait, you know, another year,
indeed,
for the fruits or the nuts to come back. And so exploiting a small land size, the area of Malta, is not thought to have been worth the while of hunter-gatherer, especially if it involves such a long and dangerous sea crossing. And the fact that we find them in Malta does append those decades of received wisdom that this was something beyond the capabilities of hunter-gatherers. Instead, we found them having this not just extraordinary seafaring knowledge, but also an extraordinary ecosystem knowledge that enabled them to live on small islands.
So could this knowledge, this new knowledge about something that was thought not possible in the past, could it be applied also to the question marks about how ancient peoples traveled to remote islands in the Pacific, for example, which some people try to twist around to make it seem like, oh, it must have been aliens involved or something, because ancient people didn't have this capability. But now we're finding out that ancient people maybe did have this capability.
I mean, the ability of humans to use oceans as a highway and rather than see it as a barrier is something that's really transformative in human history. So the bulk of human history, the sea was always a barrier. You know, people were able to cross continents or get to different islands only at periods of lower sea level when they could walk or make short trips to islands that maybe were close to the shore or perhaps get to places by accident. After all, monkeys got to South America by accident, so, you know, it can happen. But the seafaring story is is a long and complicated one that involves a lot of technologies that were developed over the ages. So what started out as probably what some academics have called culturally aided floating, obviously turned into these very long seafaring journeys like what you're referring to in the Pacific, involving outriggers and sails and all sorts of advanced technology. What we've done here in Malta is to really pinpoint a moment in human history when long-distance sustained seafaring started to happen. And this happened at a time when there were no sails.
Mm. So it was just rowing.
So it's paddling, paddling, yes. It's paddling. And, you know, but it's still obviously like a major moment because it's a moment in which the Mediterranean becomes something that we're familiar with. It's not a barrier, but a highway. Mm. And we thought that happened much later in human history. So the point when we make our discoveries in Malta, some colleagues also published a paper where they looked at the genome of hunter-gatherers in North Africa and found that they actually had European hunter-gatherer ancestry. And the timing of the entry of that ancestry into the genome is around the time we also find hunter-gatherers here on Malta. So obviously the South Central Mediterranean was a network of seafaring that actually spans continents. And that's really exciting because we didn't think humans were making regular crossings across continents over the sea until the Phoenicians, right? So this is obviously a considerably earlier time period and one that predates sails.
We're recording in 2025. Can we put the era you're talking about into this context?
So this is the time of Europe's last hunter-gatherers, about 8,500 to 9,000 years ago. The first farmers arrived on Malta about 7,400 years ago, 7,500 years ago, more or less. So it's about a millennium to a millennium and a half earlier.
Wow.
Then farming reaches this part of the Mediterranean.
Gosh.
And so these really are the people who were the survivors, are descended from the survivors of the last ice age.
When humanity was almost wiped out, am I correct?
Not humanity, but I think possibly European communities became quite fragmented during this time. Obviously, there were people occupying most of the world by that point. So humans originate about 300,000 years ago in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And successfully leave Africa about 50,000 years ago and go on to populate Eurasia, Australia, and eventually reach the Americas. Yeah. But if we're looking at specifically European hunter-gatherers, they do become very fragmented after the last ice age because of the incredibly cold conditions.
Yeah.
And they, you know, because of those cold conditions, those communities move south and within mainland Europe areas that are ice-free. So the Iberian Peninsula, the Apennine Peninsula, which is, of course, Italy and Sicily, and the Balkans become the top areas for people to inhabit. Mm-hmm. And then when the ice melts and sea levels start to rise, they start to engage with marine resources much more strongly around 10 to 9,000 years ago. And that's when we start to find them over here, where, of course, Malta is an island again. It's not connected to the mainland by that point.
We're going to go into this a bit deeper later on in the program, but for listeners who perhaps have been living under a rock or in a cave and have not heard about any of these discoveries earlier this year, we're going to talk a little bit about Professor Eleanor Sherry herself now. But literally, if you just go on Google and type in Professor Eleanor Sherry discovery, a whole bunch of articles come up, local, Maltese and international, about everything that we're talking about. And I do urge you to do so because it's really, really fascinating. Professor Eleanor Sherry, you are a professor at the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology.
That's right. So I'm what we call an independent group leader. Mm-hmm. So this means that I have almost like a miniature department of scientists. And together with my postdoctoral scientists, because most of them are postdocs, basically we are investigating a number of key themes with projects in the Mediterranean and in Africa.
You're also an associate professor here at the University of Malta?
Yes, that's right.
Here in the Department of Prehistoric Archaeology? No, that's at the University of Cologne. You have so many positions. I think I'm going to leave it in your hands. Can you tell us, give us a rundown of all the responsibilities you have? Because I'll get some of them wrong here.
Yeah, so I'm mainly based at the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology, where I'm the head of the Human Paleosystems Research Group.
That's the science of human history.
Well, it was called the Science of Human History. It has since reinvented itself as the Institute of Geoanthropology. Okay. So that's also confusing. okay. Yes, and that's where I'm primarily based conducting research with my group. Mm-hmm. But I also have affiliated positions at the University of Cologne in the Institute of Prehistory, and also at the University of Malta in the Department of Classics and Archaeology.
For a simple soul like me, how can you be in three different places at once? You're obviously allowed to be so, but
yes.
Don't sort of universities jealously guard their talent and say, oh, like in the media, I'm not allowed to be on another radio station because it'll be confusing for listeners to hear me in two places at once. But obviously in the academic world, it doesn't work that way.
No, that's right. So academics generally have a primary affiliation, which is where they're primarily based. So in my case, that's the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology, because they pay my salary, mm-hmm. and my group is based there. But you can also have any number of affiliated positions, particularly with universities you work with quite closely. Mm-hmm. So obviously I have a major project on Malta, mm-hmm. called the Island Lab Project, that's funded by the European Research Council. And so I spend a lot of time in Malta conducting research on this project that's essentially trying to understand the last 200,000 years of Maltese ecosystems, climate change, and eventually human prehistory.
And what's your association with the University of Cologne?
So this is to do with the way academia primarily works in Germany, right? So Germany, the academic system is made up of universities and research institutes. And the Max Planck Institute of Geoanthropology is a research institute.
Where is that based?
It's in Jena, in East Germany. Mm-hmm. And research institutes can't graduate students, and they can't grant academic promotion. So you generally would affiliate yourself with a German university for that purpose, which mm-hmm. is what I've done.
Yes.
So my students will graduate through the University of Cologne, and I get my academic promotions through University of Cologne, and I also do some teaching there and also at the University of Malta, because my job is research only.
I see. Well, okay, let's go back to when you started, how you ended up where you are today. Let's inspire some youngsters out there. We're recording this program during Freshers Week at the University of Malta as well. It has to be said, we want more women to be getting involved in science. I don't want to sound patronizing or anything, but I hope that you're very inspirational, not just to all young people, but especially to girls. Did you spend the early part of your life in Malta? Because you're half Maltese, aren't you?
Yes. Yes, I did. I was born here and I grew up here. And I think I spent a chunk of my formative years here, which means I love Malta. Like, I've always missed it. When I left, like, I always missed it. I always missed the sea. I missed the climate. And I miss the archaeology here, because I think from a very young age, I was about 4 years old, I think, when I told my parents I wanted to be an archaeologist.
Wow, that's really early.
Yeah, I've been on a basically laser-focused trajectory from a very young age. And I was always very interested in, I guess, like, fascinated by the idea that our world had other worlds within it. Mm. And those other worlds don't exist in the present, but in the past.
Uh-huh. Were you a big fan of, Richard Attenborough's, or is it David Attenborough?
David Attenborough's
documentaries.
Yeah.
And, you know, wildlife and...
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned Richard, because Richard Attenborough is actually my aunt's neighbour in
is
London.
Is he? Oh, my goodness.
Or he was.
The famous film director.
Yes.
And oh, my goodness.
Yes. I was always interested in prehistory, kind of broadly construed. So, you know, like, I was interested in dinosaurs. I was interested in climate change. I was interested in plants. I was interested in human prehistory. Mm-hmm. So just generally construed the fact that there was a past and the world has been a very different place, and wanted to understand that.
Did that come from people in your family that inspired you? Or?
Yeah, I mean, my mother was always very interested in prehistory and, you know, Neanderthals and dinosaurs. So, I think I'm very much like a product of my parents, but you know, my dad always loved history, but he was more sort of interested in historical periods, or I was more interested in sort of prehistoric and the natural world as well. And they, you know, they took me to, I think it was a natural history museum in London when I was about 4 years old. And, you know, I that was really, really impacted me. You know, my family always laugh and say, you know, you look very seriously at us, and said, this was the most important day of my life, I said to them.
At age four.
Yeah, and it sort of was. Wow. And, you know, they'd take me to the temples, and they took me to the hypogeum. And, of course, in those days, you could run around.
Indeed, yes. And you could go anytime you wanted.
Yes.
Almost.
And, and, you know, we spent a lot of time there. So I think, you know, it did deeply... influence me, and you know, it's I never really deviated from wanting to study these things. So as soon as I, you know, was old enough, I signed up to do archaeology here at the University of Malta.
So this is where you started?
I started here, yeah.
Okay.
Always with that focus on human evolution and deeper prehistory, which meant I was a subject of much teasing.
Really?
And you're sort of like, oh...
Why is that, though?
Well, it's like, Ellie, you know, you and your caveman. you know, lots of jokes. I mean, well-meant. And, you know, and it was always sort of pointed out to me, well, you know, you're going to have to leave because there's no hunter-gatherer prehistory on Malta. The first people to arrive on Malta were farmers. So... You know, and obviously I knew that. I always knew that to specialize, that I'd have to leave. And I did. You know, I left Malta to pursue like postgraduate studies in hunter-gatherer archaeology. So I went to the University of Southampton, where I did my master's and my PhD. And then went off and did postdocs in France at the University of Bordeaux, and then back in the UK at the University of Oxford.
Wow.
And then went to Germany for a Marie Curie fellowship, and then that sort of turned into my job. Mm-hmm. So it's quite boring, really.
would 4-year-old you be very happy with where you've got to?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Obviously, I'm sure your family is very proud of you as well.
Well, they're quite worried about me, I think. You know, there's been an awful lot of exploration as well, and crashing through jungles and deserts and encountering all kinds of like strange wildlife and
indeed.
Spitting cobras and scorpions and hippos.
Well, here's another headline of an article I found about you. UM researcher helps rewrite history. Humans lived in rainforests earlier than thought. Now, that's a different story to the one about living in Malta earlier than thought.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about this one then. And rainforests are dangerous places.
Yes.
I mean, they're beautiful, but they're dangerous as well.
Yeah, so I think, you know, when it comes to, like, when we think about human origins, we still very much have a sort of a Garden of Eden model about, you know, what that looked like, this idea that, you know, humans originate in one place, in Africa, one ecosystem, and then have to learn, you know, in easy stages to cope with how diverse the world is and different places. Whereas one of the things that I did earlier in my career is to argue that humans don't originate from one place in Africa. We have multiple routes across the continent, possibly at times like key parts of our evolution took place in Southwest Asia. And that, you know, if we don't originate in one place, then maybe different ecosystems played a role. And rainforests are not thought to have been colonized by humans until much later in human history because they're very challenging environments. But we found them in West African rainforests about 150,000 years ago.
Now, when you say we find, the word digs comes to mind. There's various pictures of you in these articles, maybe you or maybe one of your colleagues holding up a little bit of stone. It looks like a little bit of stone with some jagged edges to me, but it obviously means a lot more to you and your colleagues. So explain a little bit about the process of going about a dig and what makes you go, oh, Eureka, look at that.
Yeah, I mean, for the bulk of human prehistory, all we really have are stone tools and the most durable objects. So, you know,
anything wooden would have...
So anything, all the organics go, and acidic soils in many parts of Africa don't preserve bone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So generally all you tend to find are these stone tools. And, you know, because people only really had stone, wood, bone and antler to work with, they would, you know, make a lot of the most durable materials out of stone tools because they were the hardest material available to people back then. And in their lifetimes, people would have made hundreds, if not thousands, of stone tools. So, you know, prehistory is littered with these things. And when you find them, you know that you have an archaeological site.
Mm-hmm.
So we did find these stone tools deeply buried, and they had particular features that spoke to an early period of human prehistory known as the Middle Stone Age, which is the first and longest lasting cultural stage associated with our species, Homo sapiens. Starts about 300,000 years ago and goes on to about 20,000 years ago.
Mm-mm.
And so we found these stone tools, and, you know, we knew we had an archaeological site, that we excavated them, we knew that they were in good condition, so that they were in what we call a stratigraphic position, so it's where people had left them, and part of the reason we knew that is because quartz doesn't occur in these layers naturally. People are obviously bringing these things to the site. And, you know, you can take sediment samples associated with the archaeological materials and date them. And we use two different forms of dating. So you have two independent corroborating lines of evidence. This is beyond the age of radiocarbon. So we use something called electron spin resonance dating and something called optical luminescence dating. And so ideally you'd use two different types of dating in two independent labs and, you know, hopefully all dates converge. They did.
Okay.
And then also within the sediments, we look for ancient botanical remains to try to reconstruct the environment, because the problem in Africa with the rainforest is that African rainforests are sort of at the edge of what's viable in terms of rainfall for a rainforest. So rainforests are fed by a huge amount of rainfall. Rainforests in the Amazon and Southeast Asia get a lot more rainfall than African rainforests. So even a small change in a rain regime in Africa can fragment rainforests. Mm. So rainforests today are not necessarily rainforests in the past. And you have to prove that what you're looking at. You know, we knew it was a modern day rainforest. So we were looking about, was there a rainforest in the past?
Of course.
And so we looked at pollen. Mm-hmm. We looked at sort of fossil plant remains called phytoliths. And we also did some geochemistry, because different types of environment leave different geochemical signatures, in something called leaf waxes, which are lipids that you find on leaves that are very, very durable. And by doing all that work, we were able to prove that the environment associated with these stone tools and the ages, of course, was a rainforest.
When you say we, a typical team that's doing this, these investigations, I mean, you mentioned so many different types of science there and technology. Do you have to be know about it all, or do you have like a botanist with you and somebody who specializes in something else? I mean, how do you go about?
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, obviously we're like a hockey team. You have to have specialists with you. No one can be a specialist in everything. So So my job, I guess, is really to identify the key questions and design the research program, identify the specialists, and, you know, let them know what you're investigating and what you'd like.
Yeah.
And to sort of run the show, run the research program. Mm-hmm. And so obviously I recruited some specialists in these different areas and asked them, you know, to analyze the samples, what I expected of the samples, and they, you know, is that true? You set up the hypotheses and they test them. So I wouldn't personally have done the geochemistry work. I don't do the archaeobotany work. I'm not a botanist.
No.
I am actually specialized in the stone tools, so I can do that kind of work. Mm. But, you know, I work with a team of specialists.
A little aside, the advent of artificial intelligence, which people say is going to help in so many different areas, will it be of assistance to your in your kind of field as well?
Not yet. That's no? For sure. Usually AI gets everything about my field wrong. It's funny you mentioned that, because the other day we noticed there was a 15-minute YouTube clip with AI generated. It was all AI generated. The text was AI generated. The voice was. The pictures were about our findings on Malta. So somebody somewhere had generated like a 15-minute AI documentary about our work and managed to get everything wrong. Everything was wrong. The dates were wrong. The information was wrong. The way they described the cave was wrong. Uh-huh. They said what we found was wrong. It was from start to end a hallucination.
So definitely disseminating the information about your findings so far has not been helpful at all. But in the case of sort of doing the investigation or, I don't know, analyzing things, there's no use for it so far.
No, I actually read somewhere that I think archaeology is one of the last jobs to replace by AI.
Okay. Yeah.
So far, I mean, there are certain ways, I guess, you know, that we can use it to help us speed up research, but it definitely isn't a shortcut for the hard work.
We're going to take a little break and have some music now. And we discussed playing something by The Cure, unless you've changed your mind.
No, that's it.
Okay. Yep. Why The Cure, if you don't mind my asking?
I mean, it's been like a band that I've loved since about the age of 14, I think. And you know, and they recently produced a new album, which I also think is excellent. So, you know, they're a band that has survived and carried on producing great music.
Indeed.
And they've been on a journey, I guess, with me. They've been one of the soundtracks, I guess, of my life.
Were you a bit of a goth as a student?
No, I guess I was more the sort of nerdy alternative kid. Sort of like Cure and I guess Radiohead and
who are coming back on tour, I believe, right?
It's funny. I saw them back when I was 17 years old. I think like gone up to like Sicily when they played then just to play with REM.
Were you a 90s kid?
Yeah, okay. Definitely. Okay. I mean, I like a lot of new music too, so it's not like I've, you know, just listened to the old stuff. There's a lot of really great new bands that are coming out, but you know, The Cure is an enduring favorite, I would say, and you know, a song like A Forest, you know, it works out since I've worked in forests.
Indeed. So let's hear the classic tune by The Cure. It's a song called A Forest. So the music of The Cure, as chosen by Professor Eleanor Sherry, Associate Professor here at the University of Malta in the Classics and Archaeology Department, but a professor principally in Germany at the Max Planck Institute and the University of Cologne. Back to the conversation. How does someone like you decide where is the most prospective, where there are prospective things to be found as an archaeologist, specifically about hunter-gatherers in your case?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it really builds on a lot of experience. I was lucky when I was starting out as a young postdoc to get involved with a number of very well-funded projects that took me to the Arabian Peninsula.
Oh.
And so I spent about 10 years, I think, really working in Saudi Arabia and Oman on something called the Green Arabia Project. A PI was Professor Michael Petraglio, who was at Oxford and is now in Australia, Griffith. And that fieldwork gave me like a really good grounding in hunter-gatherer archaeology, arid land archaeology. I did, you know, go and work in forests as well after that. It's because it's nice to mix things up and, you know, keep learning new things. But you do get a sense over the years of what hunter-gatherers like. And they are very different to farmers. They're obviously not looking for like fertile fields in the same way or grazing for herds because they don't have herds. They look for places where you can get raw materials, a good view, access to water. Obviously, you know, they want to be near, you know, food sources, whether that's herds of animals, the sea or rivers or fruit trees, nuts. But you do get a sense of place. And I think a lot of people think of hunter-gatherers as cavemen. You know, and obviously they're not, first of all, you know.
Sweeping statements.
Yeah, I mean, moving away from all the sort of gender and intellectual kind of problems with those stereotypes. You know, for about 300,000 years, you know, we were highly sophisticated hunter-gatherers who lived on this earth for an incredibly long time without destroying it, you know, which is, can be contrasted to our ecological naivety today, which they wouldn't have had. They had much a much stronger ecosystem knowledge than any of us has today, almost on a sensory level that I think we'd struggle to understand because our lives are so different now.
So what you're saying is they kind of instinctively knew the circle of life, how much to hunt and when to stop and when to do more of it, when to do less, so to let things regenerate.
Yeah, they would have, and they would have just instinctively known things from the context in which they, you know, they were enculturated, in which they learned, you know, this sort of complete way of life that we've almost lost as humans, right? So even today, the limited hunter-gatherer societies have senses that we've just don't really have anymore, sort of a much finer sense of smell, for example.
Wow.
Ability to sort of sniff out prey and know the sort of sex and age of prey, you know, tracking skills that we don't have.
Is that really possible?
Yes, it is possible. If you're growing up exposed to a lifestyle, you know, humans are very plastic, you know, so we are very much a product of our enculturating environment.
Yes.
You know, and just as they probably couldn't cope with our world, we definitely wouldn't last long in theirs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we've lost a lot of ecosystem knowledge since, you know, we've at least developed more complex societies, living more politically complex societies, I suppose, not socially. They had the same degree of social complexity, maybe not the hierarchy that societies have today and the inequalities that we have today.
How would you know about their social, the way they were structured, their societies?
Yeah, I mean, you can tell a lot from things like burials. You can also look at living space structure. And of course, we also have modern analog societies because there's still a few hunter-gatherer societies alive today. I mean, when your whole way of life is based on exploiting what nature gives you and managing to eke out enough to stay alive, you need to use all the resources in your group available to you. So equality is very much selected for. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to sort of turn around to a group and say, you can't do this, you can't do that, that's going to come back to bite you.
Ah,
so you need to use everybody's labor, everybody's expertise, everybody's intelligence.
That came later with too much thinking.
Well, I mean, when you develop to agricultural societies, you start producing agricultural surpluses, which drives wealth inequality, and then it starts to like, you know, build certain changes in society. Also, when people work the land, they develop a sense of ownership over it. They want to keep hold of land, increase ownership over more land. So it has radical effects on on societies that didn't always exist. So, you know, hunter-gatherers don't have an ownership over the land. They don't work the land. So it worked very, very differently. And, you know, hunter-gatherers are really good at helping each other and fiercely maintaining equality. So, for example, in some hunter-gatherer societies, if you're the hunter who has killed the elephant, for example, for consumption, you're not allowed to consume it.
Oh. And why not?
Because the idea is that if you're the hunter and then you also claim the lion's share of the food because you've hunted it, you might get ideas above your station, start thinking too highly of yourself. You know, so there are definite rules and regulations to make sure that equality is jealously maintained, because equality is good for survival if you're a hunter-gatherer.
Goodness me. That sounds very sophisticated.
It is, yes. There's a huge level of social sophistication, but the sort of political and complexity that you get with later societies where you have social and wealth inequality are completely different. Those things perhaps weren't needed in the same way. There's very few known hunter-gatherers that had those things, and they only exist in places where there are massive food surpluses, like places in North America where you have, for example, salmon fishing, and you have huge amounts of food surplus. Mm. And then, you know, if you have food surplus, then you can occupy your mind doing other things.
The era we're talking about, do we have human remains as well, skeletons, or is it too far in the past?
I mean, the earliest human skeletons are about 315,000 years old.
So we do have.
So there are really, really old fossils of our species. Not many, very, very few for these like huge time periods. Mm-hmm. But there are a few bits and pieces.
Any found in Malta?
At Lanía.
Gosh.
We have some very small fragments of human bone.
Yeah.
But we also have DNA from the soil.
Why? I mean, archaeology has existed in Malta for quite a long time. I mean, people have been digging and finding things for quite some time. Why did it take so long for these discoveries to be made? And why at the Latnia cave, do you think? Why not, I don't know, Ardalam or one of the other places? Maybe I'm being naive here.
I mean, to answer your first question, hunter-gatherer archaeology is an archaeology of the ephemeral. It's an archaeology of the barely there. If you think about, you know, later prehistory and historic periods, you have enormous structures like the temples. They're hard to miss.
Yes.
You have pottery everywhere. You have, you know, it's much easier to find. Mm. If you're just looking for the faintest traces of hearths,
where fires would burn.
Where fires, some burnt animal bones and a few stone tools that people might not even be able to recognize as stone tools because they don't have the training.
Indeed.
You know, it's very easy to miss.
Yeah.
And also people are not looking in the right places. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for farming communities, then, you know, you tend to look at places where you have the most fertile soils that they would have used to grow crops. Whereas, you know, hunter-gatherers aren't necessarily going for the same places, and sort of a very different landscape. To your second question, like why Latnia?
Which is in the limits of Meliha.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, the hunter-gatherers that lived on Malta and the Mesolithic would have gone everywhere. They would have been all over Malta, and I think they were probably at Ardalam as well.
Okay.
If you look at the reports from Ardalam from a century ago, there are reports of things that were found that look kind of similar to what we're finding. But they were not excavated well. No one knows the context. Impossible to date at this point. Mm. So I think, you know, they possibly were there as well. And why at Latnia? Latnia has miraculous preservation. It's a sediment trap, so you have the depth of sediment for stuff to get buried. Mm. Malta has very low sedimentation because it's a semi-arid environment. There's very few trees, so there's no rivers, so you don't get the sedimentation you get in other parts of the world. But in the cave, you do get some depth, which means buried. The Mesolithic was also sealed beneath a rock collapse. Mm. So the drip line of the cave collapsed on top of the sediments and preserved them, so they didn't get washed away by when the cave filled with rainfall. So it's also like a sort of secondary miracle. And also, you know, if people are going to look for hunter-gatherers in deep, dark caves, they're not going to find them, really, because hunter-gatherers didn't live in deep, dark caves. So the stereotype of the caveman you keep coming back to, you know, they didn't live at the back of caves any more than you'd want to camp there. People didn't live there. No one wants to live in a dank, dark, nasty, bug-filled, you know...
Yeah.
Cave.
Would they sleep in the open or...?
They like rock shelters. Okay. So you look for a dry overhang, which is generally where you'd pitch your tent to. You know, so it's really... They want to live where you want to go camping. And it's funny because we found them at the place in near cave where most often people would pitch tents until we foiled them by digging a very large trench there.
Okay.
But it is, you know, there's a portion of the cave that's in the lee of the northwesterly wind, yeah, which is the dominant wind, where it's, you know, it's drier, it's higher up in the cave. Uh-huh. It's sort of a rock shelter sort of situation, whereas the back of the cave is more cave-like.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's, yeah, where we find them camping and cooking.
So these ancient peoples that you're talking about, they would make, like, tents out of animal skins?
Yeah.
And, of course. And their clothes, I suppose.
Yeah, so you have the rock shelter. You know, you'd have the back of the cave and you have an overhang. And then across the overhang, you would probably put some skin. So you're covering the front, yeah, of the cave. And then you have a shelter.
Yeah. On a purely superficial level, in the sense of sort of bringing attention to Malta being such a small island and it's not often in the news, and it's wonderful to see Malta in the news for reasons such as this. How much attention was there on the Latnia cave and on these findings and your project?
I think there were like over 100 independent news articles across the world, oh, in all different languages, about the discovery. You know, China, Australia, the UK, North America, South America.
So there are connotations.
You know, Russia.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, people are interested because there are connotations in their countries as well.
I think it's because it's a point in human history. You know, like seafaring connected us in a way that wasn't possible before in human history. And here we see... Yeah. One of the earliest examples of not just seafaring, but sustained, uh-huh, seafaring over long distances.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, really overturned what we thought about the capability of these Europe's last hunter-gatherers, which is a common story for many of us. It's a common ancestry for all of us in Europe.
Yeah.
And it's a moment. I mean, there were two centers of seafaring in the world. The Mediterranean is one of them. The other one is Southeast Asia, island Southeast Asia. Mm. There are many commonalities about the two regions, a sort of encircled warm seas that are relatively shallow and lots of islands that sort of foster like these so-called seafaring nurseries. Mm. And, you know, when does the earliest seafaring begin in the Mediterranean is obviously like a big question. Not just hops to islands, but, you know, sustained long distance seafaring that we associate with the point when really the Mediterranean stops being a barrier, but almost becomes a continent in its own right.
How different are we nowadays, today's Maltese, to these, wouldn't have called themselves Maltese, but the people that we're talking about, were they shorter than us, for example? What are the big differences? Can we look back at them and say they were the very first Maltese people?
I mean, they were the first islanders, so yes, why not? They did look a little different to us, as you'd expect from people living many, many, many thousands of years ago. I mean, humans are not as static physically. We do change over time. They had European hunter-gatherers where people who were, you know, good height. They were not sort of as short as the first farmers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first farmers tend to be quite short because they have a restricted diet. Uh-huh. Hunter-gatherers were very, very healthy in terms of diet. They, yes, ate a huge diversity of different food.
Mm-hmm. Fish and
fish, meat from the air, from the land, lots, okay, of nuts and lentils and wild foods. You know, they would have,
okay,
had an extremely broad diet.
But they wouldn't have farmed it themselves. It's just what they found.
Yeah, they would have exploited it themselves. So, for example, the hunter-gatherers at Lania were eating fish. They were eating birds. They were eating deer. They were eating tortoises. They were eating nuts. They were eating wild lentils, wild vegetables like wild carrot, for example, that grows on Malta.
Okay. And they were cooking these meats, yes, and fish.
Yes, yes, yes. There's lots of fires. Whereas the farmers, for example, mainly live on wheat. So bread and meat from domesticers. Like the first Maltese farmers who really weren't exploiting the sea much at all, and geochemistry on their bones show that, you know, they were barely, well, they weren't eating seafood, because it does leave chemical traces if you have a seafood in your diet. So they were healthy. They had dark skin. And usually light eyes, so it's an unusual and striking combination.
Yeah.
That seems to define like these late Mesolithic hunter-gatherers. Mm-hmm. Whereas the farmers coming out of the Middle East had probably dark eyes and paler skin, and you know, all of us today are a mix of those groups.
Because of course, it's farming developed in the Fertile Crescent
yes.
area.
Yes,
in
that's
the Middle
right.
East, isn't
yes.
it? That's where Mesopotamia.
Yes. Yes.
That's the area. Now, big question. Would they have had their own version of Love Island? No, seriously. How many people are there in the world who are like you doing this kind of research?
I mean, I would say a lot, but I'm probably extremely biased because that's my entire social group.
Okay. So there is a big interest. There is enough funding. Is there enough funding for, should there be more? Make your appeal.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the big questions is, you know, what is the origin of our species? How did we get here? Because it articulates with so many different areas of science, from human health to the environment, and many different angles to answering that question about human evolution. How did we shape the Earth? How did the Earth shape us? How did we evolve? How did human health become shaped? What are our weaknesses? What are our strengths? What did we do to modify environments around us? What were the feedbacks over time? So, you know, there's many different questions that articulate with, you know, us trying to understand human evolution. So, you know, it is a major topic of scientific interest and enduring public interest. I think, you know, we all want to know, where did we come from and how did we get here? What's our story?
And other things we can learn, even maybe to help us with climate change, for example. You mentioned how you were interested in it as a child.
Yeah. Obviously, we know we are facing some very severe climate challenges as a species. And, you know, for example, Malta is in a climate change hotspot. So the vulnerabilities Malta faces are, to put it mildly, extremely alarming. Mm. It's not something we think about a lot, except when there's a heat wave. But, you know, there are enormous challenges in Malta for water and heat stress. And, you know, are we going to turn into a desert? You know, lots of really, really scary issues. And obviously, you know, there are many ways in which these are being addressed. So new technologies, energy storage, clean energy. But, you know, one way I think, you know, we could be doing better in is to try to understand ecosystem resilience in Malta and what makes our ecosystems resilient and how we've lost resilience over time. So in the world at the moment, there's a big conversation about rewilding. Yeah. And so this is the idea to try to restore community ecosystems in a way that maximizes resilience to climate change. Mm-hmm. But to engage in that conversation, you have to know what you're restoring your environment to. And in Malta, we know we have degraded environments and that there's no portion of Malta that's a natural environment anymore. Everything is modified by humans. Mm. So, for example, Busquet is planted. Yeah. You know, if you go up to the Aharash of Menliha, that's extremely modified and degraded environment. It might not be houses there, but it is not a pristine natural environment. No part of Malta is.
Even the southeast, the southwest area.
Which nowhere is untouched by people. No. Everything is shaped by humans in some way. Yeah. So if we, you know, if we want to sort of answer that question for Malta and say, well, you know, how can we not just conserve but restore? You know, we have to know what we're restoring the environments to. If we don't know what they were like, how can we restore them? One of the things we're trying to do is to understand what the environments were like, what animals and plants lived in these ecosystems, and what were the community relationships like. Yeah. And then understand the consequences of their loss. What happened when the deer die? What happens when the large birds go? What happens when we lose the foxes? What happens, you know, just to give you an example, there's a type of wild lentil in Malta, and the seeds only germinate in acid, which means they would have had to have passed through the stomach of an animal to germinate. They would have been much more widespread in the past. When they lost the deer, the plants were not able to reproduce. So there's like maybe 50 of these plants left where they would have been, like Malta would have been covered with them.
Yeah.
So that's just like a small example of these community relationships. When you put these animals back in the ecosystem, completely changes like the vegetative states as well.
Yes.
And the vegetative states affect soil geochemistry, nutrient cycling, fire resistance. So you you have like a radical transformation.
It's like when they talk about the losing the bees, what a tragedy that terrible loss that would be, but on steroids, because everything is connected, isn't it?
Everything is connected. And so Malta is a very, very different place today to what it would have been in the past. It's not simply a matter of planting more trees to restore an ecosystem. We need to take a community ecosystem approach.
Yeah.
And so one of the goals of our project is to try to reconstruct that.
I see here in your CV that you have been involved in or have published around 70 publications.
It's probably pushing 80 now. There's a lot. I had a meeting this morning about the next five. There's a lot of papers, and you know, obviously, scientific papers can be fairly technical. But I do try to do a lot of outreach with the papers as well. So I will write sort of behind the paper kind of pieces, for example, in Nature or Nature Ecology and Evolution.
The magazines.
The journals.
Journals, not magazines.
Yeah, but I've also written pieces for like The Conversation, for example, which is sort of like a magazine
that you can read. Yeah,
that you can read. That sort of the unpacks the science and explains. I've written pieces for New Scientist, Scientific American,
BBC Focus.
Where you just try and like unpack and explain things in a simpler way where you don't have to know about all that stuff. It can very, very technical. You know, you don't want to look at the equations, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the kind of questions I'm asking, I mean, you know, I'd read The New Scientist or whatever. But it's still very interesting, and it's important that whatever you've discovered and you and your colleagues filters down to people like me and beyond.
Yeah, so on my website, elinorsherry.com, so kind of easy. There is a tab on publications, which also includes these sort of more popular, accessible pieces with links to them. So if anyone's interested, they can, you know, go to the website and access those plain language syntheses of the work and the significance.
Yes, absolutely. I thoroughly recommend that. The website, once again?
elinorsherry.com.
Very simple. Your greatest find. What was the moment in your career so far that made you go, oh my goodness, look at that?
I mean, it's got to be Malta, right? Like, it's got to be. I mean, you know, there is competition. Like, you know, we found a 95,000-year-old human finger in Saudi Arabia, which is like one of the oldest human remains outside Africa. You know, that was pretty good.
How
moment.
How did you know it was a finger?
I mean, it's human finger bones are very distinctive.
Oh, okay.
It did happen the day David Bowie died, so, you know, balance.
Of course.
That was pretty amazing. And you know, obviously, you know, the day we realized that we had humans in rainforests 150,000 years ago was really exciting as well. But, you know, I think the Malta find, apart from being very close to my heart, was something... just took a very profound moment, because in 2019, you know, I was digging this 1x1 meter trench that led to the discovery. So I was, you know, I was only one person fits in a 1x1. So I was just there. And I'd gone through, you know, the farmers, you know, the early farmers. And so, you know, I didn't expect to find anything else. But
of course, the strata you're talking about, the levels, yeah?
Yes, but then I realized there was something older. And I knew back in 2019, this looks like it's older. And it looks like hunter-gatherers. And you sort of don't want to believe yourself. But, you know, I knew back in 2019 that we'd found something really special. And that was really exciting. And, you know, obviously you try to break it. You try to test it. You try to say, well, what else could it be? What would it look like if I'm wrong? And that's why it took us about 5 years to publish, because we really went over and above with the excavation, testing, retesting, multiple different lines of evidence before we stuck our neck out to say we've got something that overturns an accepted theory.
Well, long may you continue with your work and make many, many more discoveries.
Thank you.
A word of advice from you to aspiring young archaeologists or people listening who might be trying to make up their mind what to do with their careers, with their lives?
I mean, I think you have to have passion for what you do, because it's very hard work, and you do end up making a lot of personal sacrifices to like push your career, unless it's something you love.
But it is
rewarding.
That
can be very difficult to do. It's incredibly rewarding, but it, you know, it is hard work, and you have to have passion for it. Mm. And I think, you know, having passion for what you do is, you know, you can't put a price on that in life, right? You know, it is a gift, but it is something, it's a gift that you work very hard for.
Absolutely. Well, I definitely consider you one of Malta's superheroes.
Thank you.
Malta's Lara Croft, minus the guns and the temples. Lara Croft, who goes further back in history. Who else can we compare you to? Indiana Jones, of course, and all those cliches. But fantastic stuff. And it's been such a great pleasure and an honor talking to you today. Professor Eleanor Sherry of the University of Malta, but also University of Cologne and the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And I hope to invite you again in a few months' time to have an update maybe on some new discovery.
Well, I'll keep you hanging on that cliff, yep. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dakin Colin Fitz jistaqsi fuq 103.7 campus. Programm li xandar nar ta' sibt fl-erba' ta' wara nofsinhar, repetizzjoni il-ħadd fit-tlieta. Programm li jitella wkoll fuq is-sit elettroniku ta' campus 103.7 tistgħu issibuh fis-sezzjoni on demand. Nerġgħu niltaqgħu bħal-lum ġimgħa fl-istess ħin sa dakinhar. Grazzi u saħħa.